Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. In this episode, I will be speaking with Jonathan W. Hackett on his book, Theory of Irregular War, published by McFarlane & Company, Incorporated, in 2023. Jonathan W. Hackett is a U.S. Marine with two decades of experience. He has held positions at the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the Marine Corps Special Operations Command, and the Marine Corps Operating Forces prior to teaching full-spectrum human intelligence operations and security cooperation in Dam Neck, Virginia. Jonathan Hackett, welcome to the New Books Network.
Yeah, thank you.
We always like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself and what's the backstory behind writing this book?
Well, my backstory is probably a little bit different than most people who write about military studies and stuff like that. I'm actually an interrogator, and I've been in special operations and intelligence for the last 20 years. So while a lot of people write about this stuff from the comfort of their office, I actually was in many of the places that I have written about in this book. A lot of the things, of course, in history, I was not there for that, but so that I had to go and do the reading just like everybody else. But my service in those places is kind of what prompted me to say I should write something about this, especially in places like Kurdistan in the Middle East and Java in Indonesia and in Lebanon, because there's a couple of things in the book that I kind of draw out about territory and society and things like that. And in those places, I really saw those problems amplified to a degree where it became a question of why is this happening? So when I got back from all that stuff, I'm actually retiring soon. So when I got back from all of that, I said, I should sit down and analyze this and write about it.
Now, what are some of the intellectual influences in writing this book? You did just mention your own personal experiences, but also right. were there any like intellectual influences on how to understand this topic?
Definitely. So other writers, oftentimes they go to certain authors like David Galula, Roger Trinquier, and some others. I did not do that. I did, of course, read their materials, but the things that actually positively influenced my framework were more of the political science genre. So John Locke's Second Treatise on Government was very important because he talks a lot about how a state performs in an ideal capacity. Because what I write about is a non-ideal state. So in order to talk about the non-ideal state, you first have to understand, well, what does the right state look like in a perfect world? And he wrote a very lengthy treatise on that, which also influenced our own Declaration of Independence and everything like that. So that was very important. I also really liked Kenneth Waltz's Man, the State, and War, which he wrote in 1959. And he also fought in war and came back from the war and then wrote about this and became a very influential scholar in the field. And that was a book about how people and their states interact and how that can lead to war. And the kind of war he was talking about is a little different than what I was talking about. But I thought it was a useful approach to kind of looking at people differently than the conflict, because I think that is different. He also had the theory of international politics, which is a foundational text in international relations theory. Even the theories that disagree with him have to trace themselves back to him. So it's a very important book, I think, for understanding the kind of framework I'm using. And there's a couple of other authors like John Tilley and John C. Scott. John C. Scott, especially, he wrote a book called Seeing Like the State, which talks about how states do this centrally planned approach to solving problems, which is not always the best approach. Especially in societies that are not fully modernized. And we can get into that later about modernization theory and things like that. But his book it's a very interesting, very deep look at some different cases in Latin America, the Middle East, and other places too. And then John Tilley, as I mentioned, he wrote Coercion Capital and European States. It's a European-focused book, but it talks a lot about how economics, especially free market economics, interact with people that are in conflict, and what are the outcomes of that. It's a very interesting book. So there are a lot of others, but those four kind of they rise to the top time and time again as I was analyzing these things.
So just to give our our listeners kind of like a basic idea. What do you mean in the most basic sense of irregular war? Like, how does it compare to regular war? We're definitely going to get into more details throughout the interview, but just to give like a real basic introduction.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing, because a lot of people think that there's only one type of war because they're students of Clausewitz, who Clausewitz himself said that actually the war he was writing about was very specific. It was Cabinetskrieg, which is between different war departments of countries, basically, and that his book did not apply to a bunch of other cases, including Volkskrieg, which was people's war. So irregular war is it's a last resort of people. So it's a choice that people make, which is different than a choice that governments make. And actually, Locke, going back to what he wrote earlier about special, you know, perfect governments, there's a quote that I really love by him. He said, "Great mistakes in the ruling part, many wrong and inconvenient laws, and all the slips of human frailty will be borne by the people without mutiny or murmur," which I think is really, that encapsulates it, because people will suffer for a very long time before they choose to actually resort to violence because the costs are too high and all these other things. And that choice to cross over is part of what irregular war is. It takes a severe disconnect between what people expect of their sovereign, whatever that might be, because it's different in different contexts, and then what the sovereign actually delivers. And in the case I'm talking about a sovereign, I mean the state. And when this relationship is negative, I call it sovereign dysfunction. And sovereign dysfunction is a really important concept. It's new to the discipline. It's something I came up with. And actually, one of my peer reviewers, when I was putting my book through peer review, was complaining because they'd never heard this phrase before. And I just thought to myself, well, that's good, because I came up with it. So it's a central component of my argument throughout the book. And basically, given a condition of sovereign dysfunction, irregular war takes place outside established systems. I call this, like, in a more colloquial sense, trading ballots for bullets. So instead of going to vote away your issues, you're shooting away the issues. And that's a very simplified, you know, way to look at it, but that's kind of a way to ground it. There are like three important areas there that this choice will be made where the state is out of sync with what the people expect. And those areas are social order, sovereign territory, and political economic institutions. And these three things don't have to all be happening in a negative way at the same time. And in fact, I argue in the book that each one has its own type of beginning and end, but they can happen together. So I'm gonna get into that in the book.
Yeah, so the state is a real important part of understanding like why irregular war even exists. It's kind of where, when the state kind of is in a dysfunctional state, as you kind of said, the sovereign dysfunction, that's kind of, whereas regular war is kind of when the state is kind of operating as it should. Is that kind of, would that be a good way of kind of, I know it's simplifying, but is that a good way of understanding this?
Yeah, and actually I talk a lot about expectation in my book, because, you know, let's say you're in China or you're in Venezuela or you're in Mexico, each of those states, the people living there have a different expectation about what the state should do for them. And it's not about how we, the outside, view the state's operations. That's not the main reason that these people have a grievance or have an issue that they cannot solve. And in some cases, the thing that might look terrible to us is totally acceptable to them and is not a dysfunctional thing in their context. So it's what do they actually expect and what are they getting? And if there's a huge enough disconnect between those two things, there's now a condition for the people to begin violence, essentially, to regain the equilibrium they're looking for.
Now, what are some of the major theoretical frameworks necessary to understand irregular war? You actually kind of mentioned three, and I'll just quickly list them, and then you can explain them. You say it's people-centric, then state-centric, which we kind of have dealt with a little bit, and then military-centric. Probably, is that kind of like the strategy and tactics of irregular war?
Yeah, there's kind of those three different veins. The military-centric one is very common, especially in the West, and it's doctrine-focused, so it's prescriptive in nature. It's not designed to ask why, or it's not even designed sometimes to ask what is going on. Instead, it's how do we do something? Which I think is problematic. You should always understand the why first before you start doing something, because if you look at the wars in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan, and many other cases, if you don't understand why people are doing what they're doing and then solve the why, your how is ineffective at the very least. Moving up in degree of usefulness, then there's the state-centric theory or framework, which is really basically international relations theory and political realism and kind of the stuff that you learn in political science about how to look at world conflict. And the key takeaway there is that states are black boxes, that, you know, their internal dynamics are not as relevant to how those states interact with other states. So, you know, China interacting with the United States, it's just one entity and another entity interacting in this anarchic world. That's the state-centric framework. And a lot of, again, Western approaches take this state-centric framework when they're looking at irregular war. And I think that's problematic because really it's the third one, people-centric, that I think is probably the most helpful way to start looking at these issues. Those come from the social sciences. So you've got the foundational thinkers like Karl Marx, Max Weber, Emile Durkheim, and then later thinkers like John C. Scott and Tainter, who wrote a book about the collapse of complex societies. And that's looking at more of what's going on with the people here. Doesn't have to be a state at all. It could just be a band of folks who have issues. How do they resolve those issues? So what the approach that I took mostly was the people-centric approach, but I discuss in detail the other two just to kind of juxtapose them next to each other so that the reader can make a choice about what approach they would like to use.
Yes, and there's actually now a growing field of the sociology of violence and war. One of my colleagues, Sanisha Malcevich, has written quite a lot about that, and just how, in some ways, how conflicts operate in different contexts can be as much about the social contexts as anything else, rather than just merely tactical or the technology that we sometimes, especially in the West, we kind of have that in the popular imagination. And yeah, we're kind of even seeing that right now with Ukraine. Like, well, why are the Ukrainians fighting this way as opposed to the way that we're used to? Well, you know, it's a different context, and it's just so forth, and also just part of their military heritage too, because they're still operating a little bit with that Soviet heritage.
Yeah. Definitely.
Now, you use this term grounded theory, and could you explain this and how it applies to understanding irregular warfare?
Sure. So this is actually developed by a scholar named Glaser decades ago, and it's well suited for qualitative studies. So where you lack like strong numerical data, this is a helpful way to start out your journey. So it's not the theory that you would use for the entire study, but it's to help you begin. And it really brings these kind of disparate data sources together that otherwise you'd have a hard time analyzing next to each other. And it's, like I said, it's for qualitative research, but, and it's really with quantitative research, you want to get big numbers, big data, and do this like deep, you know, regressive analysis of something, or compare numerous variables and things. And sometimes you just don't have the data to do that. And with irregular war, you don't, especially when there's so much personal things involved in these conflicts. The data is questionable. The data might not exist. And many other problems, you know, perhaps the people that you'd like to talk to interview are dead. So you can't go track down that data either. So a lot of primary sources that you typically rely on for non-violent studies does not exist here. So it basically helps you if you don't have thick description, if you don't have interviews, if you don't have memoirs, primary sources, things like that. It gives you a way to kind of set these things up next to each other and then inductively draw out your starting points. So, for example, when I was talking about Indonesia in the book a couple of times, I used grounded theory to start out, where should I begin analyzing why the Dutch lost the conflict? Because by all data points, the Dutch should have won the conflict against the Javanese in after World War II ended. And in fact, the Dutch knew more about the Javanese order of battle than the Javanese did, and the Dutch still lost. So what else is going on here? And grounded theory kind of helps you plot through that question so that you can start expanding out more analysis.
Now, a key component in irregular war, and this gets back to the question of you have to understand the why rather than necessarily the how, and that kind of gets into ideology. Now, I know this is a very complex topic, but could you kind of do the best you can to summarize, like, what role does ideology play usually in irregular war?
So there's, like you said, a huge focus on ideology in scholarship. Some scholarship argues that ideology is the most important factor in irregular war. I disagree. I show in my book how it doesn't actually explain why people are choosing to fight these types of wars. Instead, I take the approach that ideology is a precursor component that forms or helps to form a worldview. Then a person takes that worldview, they view the way things are with that worldview, and then they form expectations about how the sovereign should deliver those results. And then if it doesn't meet those expectations, they have a reaction to that. Now, way earlier in that chain, causal chain I just described, ideology was a component, but it was not the only component. It wasn't a sufficient condition for this conflict to occur. Instead, it forms kind of the underlying framework of why people even look at things the way they did. And the way of thinking of ideology like this that I'm using, it actually came from Ali Shariati, who is an Iranian philosopher in the 1970s. He gave a bunch of lectures on how inside of a revolution, there are thinkers and there are actors. And these are two separate groups of people. And ideology forms the worldview of these thinkers and these actors. And then all the other participants that decide to go along and bandwagon in this militia or group or whatever. And he asked what ideology did to those people, which is very different than you look at Western writings on it. Then ideology is, you know, hate for the West, or, you know, in the Ukraine situation, the, you know, the Russians have irredentist claims to Eastern Ukraine. That's an ideological approach. But that's not really that's not answering the question of, like, what's going on here. It's just kind of describing it instead of explaining it. So I think it's important to take that different view, when especially looking in the context of what I've analyzed here.
Now, I know this differs from case to case, but what are the usual type of actors involved in irregular war? You kind of just mentioned one, like militias, obviously not, usually the participants are not usually part of the regular state, even though the state may be fighting them. So they obviously have to operate outside of the confines of the state. What type of forces are usually kind of formed and so forth? And I know it differs from case to case, but what can we say about it in a general sense?
Well, it's great that you said it varies, because when I was doing my analysis, I was trying to write it in such a way that it could be very broadly applicable. So I would break it into three categories of actors. Two of them are necessary, and one of them is kind of an optional ingredient. The necessary actors are, first, the state. So the state is, you know, whether that's a military or a security institution or whatever element, whatever instrument of that sovereignty is. The second ingredient is a people subject to that state sovereignty. And that's an important connection, that they're subject to that state sovereignty. And they found some condition that's so egregious, remembering back to what Locke said, that it has to be exceptionally egregious for them to decide that this unmet expectation is enough to resort to violence to reconcile it. And then the third kind of optional ingredient is what I call third-party intervention. That's when another state or another element, it could be another militia or another security force or something, comes in and starts participating. And when you look at a lot of cases, this third-party intervention takes many different forms. Look at ISIS, for example. There were thousands of foreign fighters joining ISIS independently on their own. Then there were groups that were joining ISIS as groups, you know, and then there were states, you know, fighting against them that were joining coalitions and things like that. That's just one small case. Then you have the Spanish Civil War, where you had Germany and Russia, the United States and Britain fighting against each other, basically in a rehearsal for the Second World War right before it started, with a bunch of independent brigades also fighting their own battles in this conflict. So there's a huge array of actors in a third party intervention. But the important thing is it's not necessary. The first two, the state and the people, are definitely necessary.
Now, when we were just discussing ideology, you noted that it's not the all-encompassing motivation for participating in a irregular war. So what are some of the common motivations, like for the everyday participants, if ideology is not as critical as you just said?
This is actually really important, this what motivates people, to my job as an interrogator, because I need to understand why someone's doing something, and especially even my adversary, and make them agree to work with me. So what's going on inside their brain? So this is something near and dear to my heart. And what we take in my field is two different approaches. One is an intrinsic motivation pathway, and one is extrinsic. And the extrinsic motivations are these things in the world around you that might contribute to your choice to do something. And there's four of them. It's money, ideology, coercion, and excitement. And you notice that ideology is in there. These are extrinsic, though, which means they're not the actual reason that the person is doing something. Instead, there are intrinsic motivations. There happen to be five of them. There are others, but there are five main ones, especially through Robert Cialdini's research in the 1980s on influence that the CIA actually uses. They use these five intrinsic motivators, and that's something called reciprocity, authority, social proof, consistency and commitment, liking and scarcity. And, you know, we could have hours of discussion on these things, but I would say, what do they look like in practice? Well, think about gangs. Why do people join gangs? If you use an extrinsic motivation model, you might say, oh, they're joining out of excitement, or they're joining to get money, or they're forced to, like if you're talking about MS-13, you know, they're getting beaten into this gang. Okay, but this only explains behaviors on the surface, not why the person is choosing to behave that way. So instead, let's look intrinsic and say, well, maybe that person grew up in a broken home. Maybe they had no family at all. So that means they had no social proof. They had no authority. They were lacking consistency, right? Then perhaps they're poor. Food was scarce. That's scarcity. Security can be scarce also. So maybe the neighborhood security is weak. And then no one might have accepted them or liked them. And I've just hit on all five of the motivating types in the intrinsic model. Now, then let's say some group shows up with its own identity, its own internal consistency, its own form of security for certain people that get it, its own authority, a sense of belonging that it provides, and even an ownership in the group that steps in and says, hey, join us. Now the intrinsic motivators that I mentioned before are acting on that person in that moment, in those specific conditions, and it's beckoning them to join, and it's a very powerful force. So the reason I kind of went into the gang one and not irregular war is because it doesn't really matter what activity the person's doing. These motivators apply. You know, it could be, why do you feel bad about not giving a gift on Christmas if you received a gift on Christmas? And that's reciprocity. And it's an intrinsic force that kind of pushes you to do something. And I don't think we look at it, the war, this way very often. And I think that's to our detriment.
So this is kind of getting more into like psychology of war rather than necessarily strategy and tactics.
Absolutely. And I try to stay out of strategy and tactics for the book, because I think there are so many books on so many different strategies and tactics, and there are very few books dealing with the why of these conflicts.
Now, we did touch on this a little bit earlier about the relationship of sovereignty and sovereign territory. How does, and again, we could probably get into hours and hours of discussion on this because these are key factors in political theory, but how does this kind of relate a little bit to irregular war? We did talk about how, in some ways, this is almost like the dysfunction or the breakdown of sovereign power over its own territory. Is there anything more to this dynamic too that you can add?
Yeah, I'll use an example to describe it so it's a little more grounded. So in 1946 in Iran, there were some provinces in the northwest that were trying to become independent. One of those was called Mahabad, which is a Kurdish ethnic area. And that area was basically agitating and took up arms. There were several thousand armed folks that declared independence for Mahabad. Well, the Shah did not accept that, so he sent a punitive expedition out there. But the problem is the territory, the physical territory, was so extremely mountainous, and there was deserts and all these other challenges along the way that it weakened the force. And there was no way for the Shah to actually exert real sovereignty over that physical space. And that lack of sovereignty and the lack of services provided through that sovereignty and the territory led those people to decide that this is our time to become independent. There are many other examples of how this works, but the center of it is that there's a power center, and that power center cannot exert sovereignty over another physical area. You see this a lot in Sudan and South Sudan, which is an example I also look at in the book, where Khartoum in Sudan could not exert sovereignty over South Sudan, or what South Sudan is today. And that was a major contributing factor to South Sudan's independence. And of course, there are deserts, mountains, seas, all these different things. But what they have in common is the challenge, the tyranny of geography, essentially, that is interfering and stopping the sovereign from actually exerting authority over that space.
Kind of reminds me a little bit like how even in the British Isles, they used to have trouble with the Highlanders.
Exactly.
Because of the terrain, you know, they were just able to kind of exert their own independence. Is that kind of a little bit like what you're getting at?
Definitely. It's actually like the movie Braveheart, you know, where these folks just refused the sovereignty, and the king had a hard time because of the land. I mean, the geography itself was an impediment.
Now, also, one area you touch on, and we did kind of discuss this too, but there's also the concepts of social solidarity and social order. And in some ways, you kind of talked about that with the psychological factor of how, in some ways, these irregular forces, they can actually provide some of the social order or even social solidarity better than the sovereign. Is there more you want to discuss about that?
Yeah, definitely. And the thing that pops into my mind is Lebanon. There are many examples within the Lebanon case over time that we could use, but Hezbollah specifically is a great example because they provide social services, they have hospitals, they collect taxes, they do a lot of things that look like what a state does. They have their own military force, a very effective military force, and some would argue it's the most effective Arab military force that's been tested in combat against non-Arab militaries. And all that said, they are not a state. They are a irregular force with a political wing and a military wing. You know, there's about a dozen politicians in the Lebanese parliament who are members of Hezbollah's political wing. And you've got tens of thousands of forces in the south and things like that, South Lebanon. And they basically carved out a social order that was missing or dysfunctional from the main government in Beirut and made it their own. So if you were in South Lebanon living there in one of these areas that's controlled by Hezbollah, it would be in your interest to work with them, because how else will you get medical care? How else will you get food, water, shelter, et cetera? So looking down at like the local village level, there are some life and death decisions made by people about who do we side with? And maybe you don't agree with the ideas of that group, but you might want food and you might want security, just like we were talking about with the gangs that could provide some of these things that the central power cannot provide.
And I remember years ago reading about this, about how even that's led to the popularity of Hamas, which,
yes,
of course,
yes,
is already in the news already. But Hamas was able to build up its support because it was able to provide a lot of social services, which even the regular PLO was not able to, or the Palestinian Authority was able to do in certain areas.
Yeah, that's an excellent example, a very, very complex example that involves territory, social order, and institutions. All the three things that I view as problematic are occurring in Gaza.
Now, how does irregular war relate to standard military and strategic theory? And we did mention Clausewitz, that he's usually like the standard. And he was not completely unfamiliar with this, because there was the War of Liberation against Napoleon with the Landswehr and the Landsturm. And he was an advocate of those forces with the Prussian reform movement.
Right. He actually helped author the Landsturm Edict, which is, I think, a more important document than On War for looking at irregular war. And as I said earlier, Clausewitz himself in his own book says that the thing he's writing about does not apply to every war. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm a Marine in the military, and we always look back at Clausewitz and say, like, oh, Clausewitz says that the nature of war is unchanging and it's just the character that changes. And I have to ask, have you read the earlier part of that passage that says that this only applies to wars between military cabinets? It does not apply to people's war. In fact, he has a chapter towards the end called Volkskrieg, which talks about people's war, and he just disparages it the entire time. And basically from a perspective of an outsider, saying that this type of war doesn't make sense, I don't understand it. I wish he could have finished his book, because maybe he would have gone into some theory about that, but we won't see that. But a lot of standard military theory and strategy, a lot of it comes from Clausewitz, and a lot of it comes from Jomini, who is the French leader on the other side with Napoleon's forces, who had a very mechanical approach to war about numbers and forces and maneuver and, you know, the critical point and all these things, which is great in certain contexts, but not when it's a war between the people and the state. And those two thinkers and a couple of others from that period, all with some interesting ideas, unfortunately, their ideas kind of just went in different directions and never were used for what they were intended for when we're talking about irregular war. And I think a lot of that has to do with Western militaries, especially the United States, loves technology. So we love, you know, huge amounts of force, overwhelming maneuver forces. And, you know, I believe it was Sun Tzu talked about it as an egg cracking against a grindstone. This is what these forces desire. I mean, that's the outcome we're looking for, is like overwhelming destruction and defeat of a similar adversary, like a peer or near peer adversary, which would be a state, not a group of people. So already we're basically trying to jam this strategy that's designed for something else into the irregular war context. And as we've seen through history, it does not work out, has not worked out, not just for the United States. Vietnam is a great example, because the French were defeated first in 1954 in Dien Bien Phu. The U.S. came in to help. The U.S. was ousted in 1975. Then China came in and could not defeat the Vietnamese either. So three huge powers could not defeat this very small space, you know, and you have to ask, like, well, what tactics and strategies were they using? And I think they weren't applicable or useful for this type of war.
Now, one aspect that usually gets neglected in irregular war is how it applies to economics, because of course they got to supply themselves, and also, like you said, with the social order, the social services, they got to provide the funds for that. And how does this kind of relate to it? Because in some cases we do see, I believe in Colombia, we have like connections with drug trades and also with the cartels in Mexico. But how do irregular wars usually tend to relate to economics?
Well, there's a couple of different veins on that. And one of them is, how do these groups, the non-state groups, how do they fund themselves? And it comes down to basic market economics. Like, you look at ISIS, for example, they were selling oil. They also had gold trade going on. They were selling looted objects from the museums in Iraq and Syria, all to fund this black market trade to help them purchase weapons and do, you know, material acquisitions and logistics and things like that. And you mentioned Colombia with the drug trade. Absolutely. That's capitalism again. I mean, in Iran too, because they can't use the international banking system, the SWIFT banking system. They've developed a very robust black market economy that's controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, where if you want to buy an iPhone in Iran, it's going to cost you $5,000 to $7,000. And most of those thousands of dollars are going into the black market mandatory, you know, tax that these groups are taking out to fund themselves. So people will always find ways to fund themselves. But then there's the other question about, what if economics was the reason that the war started in the first place? Then how does that change the dynamic? Because you look at places like, again, with ISIS, but in Iraq before that, Iraq was able to fund itself, number one, through great power support. I'm talking about in the Gulf War in 1991. And before that, it had just fought a war in between Iran and Iraq, huge Western support, international support, even to Saddam Hussein, but he had oil. You know, he had a commodity that was of high interest to external buyers that helped him prop himself up. And that's not an irregular war, that's a regular conventional war, but same principles of economics apply there, that, you know, this patron and client system between a benefactor, an outsider, and an insider. And I think it's very interesting if you look back at ISIS using gold coins as their currency, and taxing people in all different aspects, you know, both locally and to cross through different areas. And they had a really elaborate way to extract money from the people that were subject to their authority, that the Iraqi government and the Syrian government did not have that authority and could not extract that money. And it just shows where was the sovereignty seated. And you can follow the money and see that in this case, the ISIS case, it was with the ISIS caliphate and not with the government in Baghdad or in Damascus between like 2011 to 2018, for example.
It reminds me of a story that David Kokurin, who's a major expert in counterinsurgency, but he kind of made a note like how even in places like Syria, people can just log on to their iPhones, their smartphones, and get like market rates, market rates. And they would do like even currency exchange and all that. And that's another way how they were able to fund themselves. And it was just, they just had that at the tips of their fingertips. And in some ways that's even outside of the control of the official government.
Yeah. Yeah. They do that with the gold exchange, especially. And also with commodities like milk, sugar, flour, they'll be bartering these things way below the regular economy and creating their own sub economy with these commodities.
Now, I know you mentioned that the book is not primarily about strategy and tactics, but of course, it's kind of also impossible not to address the issue. But what are some of the common strategies and tactics of irregular war? And again, I know it varies from case to case, but what can we say from like a general overview perspective?
Typically with like any military operation, you're going to look at what does the situation call for and what resources do we have and what kind of will is there. And I'm thinking about the Ukrainians in the Second World War fighting with a very well-organized military, though they were not a state military, when in an operation called Case Black and Case White, when the Germans were fighting against these partisans, Winston Churchill actually observed it and said that these forces were fighting in a more organized manner than the British forces were on the other side of the continent, which is very interesting. He was talking from a conventional perspective. They had regiments, they had brigades, all carefully organized and everything like that. And they were doing mechanized infantry maneuvers, you know, something you would not expect perhaps in the southern Philippines with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front rebels, right? And a lot of times the question can be answered by which party are we talking about? Is it the state or the people? Because the state generally has, you know, relatively unlimited resources for at least a set period of time. That means a lot of technology, a lot of intelligence, a lot of forces. And on the other side, the people are generally less staffed than the state is. So that means they're doing what they can with what they've got. And there's that ubiquitous Toyota Hilux joke we always make about, you know, the Toyota Hilux can be found anywhere with any configuration of weapon system in the world, depending on what conflict is going on. And it's very true, you know, from Mali to Afghanistan to Latin America, you just mount an anti-aircraft weapon on the back of it. And that's what you're going to do that day. You know, it's doing what you can with what you got. But a lot of times, the smaller force is able to kind of outsmart the larger force because of the tyranny of size in that context, especially if you look at French counterinsurgency. The French threw thousands and thousands of forces against many of their counterinsurgency fights, and yet they never really succeeded. And a lot of times their adversary, whether that's the Algerians or the Vietnamese, the Moroccans, the Malians, they relied on their smaller numbers to evade and trick and basically outmaneuver in a smaller context those massive, you know, conventional forces that are designed to fight other conventional forces. They're not designed to fight people.
Yeah, I kind of remember even in Northern Ireland, the IRA kind of would have to use their wits to try to, and technical know-how to try to outsmart the British. And even in certain contexts, in private contexts, even some of the British intelligence officers had to say they actually kind of they actually had to respect these guys or admire their ingenuity. It's like, well, we probably wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, actually, I think it was like something like 60% of the MI5 budget in the 1990s was for 600 IRA fighters. They were going after just that small number of folks. And that was a big IRA strategy, especially in the later 20th century, was just inflicting economic damage or cost on the British with very small actions. So like blowing up a vehicle that destroyed a city block that cost $1 billion in repair damage. Well, that was a victory for those guys, because that's what they wanted to do, is inflict economic cost. And they did.
Now, how does irregular war relate to insurgencies and revolutions? These are two common examples of irregular war, but not all irregular war are insurgencies or revolutions.
Yeah, it's kind of like a little Venn diagram. You know, sometimes there's overlap, but I think a great example to kind of highlight how these things can be different, or at least nested, is the American Revolution, which was not the American Revolutionary War. The American Revolutionary War was a component of that much larger American Revolution, you know, and that American Revolution was intellectual. It was a change of social order, whereas the Revolutionary War was an insurgency, basically a group that is not a state attempting to violently overthrow a state, which is that textbook definition of insurgency. And in that context, you had the Venn diagram kind of overlapping, where, or actually nested inside of that, where the war, the revolution was an idea, and the war, the insurgency, was a component, but not the whole thing.
And there's also the counterinsurgency theory of David Gallupta. I believe you mentioned him earlier in the interview.
Yes.
What is his significance in this topic?
So he's an important author because he wrote in the 1960s. He observed a lot of the French counterinsurgencies going on in Southeast Asia and Indochina at the time. And his analysis was on primarily Marxist organizations. So he had a very limited scope. He never really acknowledged that that was his limitation. He just kind of went with it as if it's applying to everything, which is kind of bad, because later on, and when we had our own wars in the US and the Middle East, we kind of looked at his writings as though it's universal, and it's really not. And it's not a wrong framework, but it's really narrow, and it's a specific type of group dynamic, and it fails to explain all insurgencies. Even the reasons that they form in the first place, he never really got into that. He was more interested in the phases that an insurgency might go through, and kind of taking this abstract approach to it without actually looking at, is this really how these things happen? But again, it wasn't wrong. It just was not inclusive.
Now, from the other side, we get Mao Zedong, who kind of formulated people's war or guerrilla warfare, which was kind of a very good, even though it is Marxist-based, but it is kind of a common framework for irregular war, even to this day. What's his significance?
Yeah, it's really important what he wrote, because it's a good example of how the author understood the context of the conflict he was writing about. And Mao was writing about the specific issues going on in China. You know, he was talking about Japanese against the Chinese. He was talking about the Vietnamese leaders training inside of China to go fight the French. And there were a lot of very important contextual things in Mao's world. And remember, his worldview is formed by an ideology and all that stuff. So the Marxism is kind of that ideology in the background. But it was more about a military approach to solving a military problem. And if you look at his way of framing it, it's very methodical. And it's almost like these ebbs and flows of a wave. You know, the wave crests and then it crashes and it crests and it crashes. And that's how he wanted to design the timeline of his forces, basically growing in strength, then rapidly striking and then shrinking again, and then growing again, and repeating this cycle, essentially, which goes into something called forward defense, which is a strategy that modern China has, but borrowed from Mao. And actually, after World War II ended, it's interesting because Mao was not allowed to be part of the military decision-making authorities until they lost a couple of conflicts. And then they said, well, maybe you should come back in here. And he did. And then he developed this forward defense strategy, which is basically, it's called luring in deep. So luring the adversary deep inside of Chinese territory and then encircling them and enveloping them and eating them, destroying them. And that is today a current strategy China still retains from Mao's writings.
Now, another Marxist communist theorist was Che Guevara, who he fought with Fidel Castro, and he came up with Foucault theory. What is that? And also, how does it contrast or compare to Mao Zedong's writing?
Yeah, Che Guevara's writing is sometimes disparaged as a ripoff of Mao Zedong, and in many ways, there's certainly a lot of plagiarism in there. But he does have some original ideas, not good or bad, it's just original. One of those ideas is that the conflict should start in a rural context, so out in the jungle or the forest, and then once it's gained enough momentum, then that force should move into an urban environment and then focus on the urban environment. So Foucault just means focus, and it's where is the focus of the fight going on. And at the same time that he was writing this, you know, some of it was succeeding, like early years of the Cuban Revolution, it was succeeding, but in other parts of Latin America, it was not. There was another fighter named Carlos Marighella in Paraguay, who was also a Marxist, and he was writing a similar book, but from an opposite perspective about how the conflict should start in the urban environment and then move to the rural environment. So in a similar place with a similar ideological background, you had two different approaches that were being taken. You could argue that Marighella was successful because he was actually a politician later on, whereas Guevara did not survive to hold office much longer after he wrote that book. So it's a very interesting context there in Latin America during the time that both of those books were written.
Yeah, and also part of that context with the urban guerrilla warfare was the Tupamaros in,
absolutely,
I believe in Argentina they were operating in.
Yeah, the Tupamaros are very important too, because it was very localized. You know, it's not a kind of conflict that can move from one country to another, in my opinion, because it was a very specific problem between the social order dysfunction and the sovereign in that area where they were fighting.
Now, what are some of the problems in trying to understand irregular war? You mentioned quite a few. First one was scope, method, bias, and character. Could you explain these?
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to earlier when I said that I took the people-centric approach, but there's these two other approaches, the state-centric and the military-centric. A lot of these problems come from the military-centric and the state-centric approaches. And I spent a great deal of time actually looking into these and like, where did they come from and how do they have an effect on way things happen? Because they're so pervasive and ineffective. And I wanted to show that, hey, these things exist, and we might want to think about that when we're trying to plan for some of these conflicts. So for example, method, there's actually a word that Clausewitz uses called methodismus, or methodicism, which is basically an unscientific way of going through steps to do something that you claim is scientific. And he accuses a lot of military practitioners of doing this. He even says that people who write books about the art of war fall into this category. So Jomini, for example, his arch rival in military theory, he criticized Jomini a lot about using the art of war, because to Clausewitz, it was a science. But Jomini was trying to say that his was a science, but it was in fact just, you know, an idealistic rendering of what Jomini wished war would be. Same thing with Sun Tzu, Art of War. Clausewitz would have probably looked at that as a dream document, not necessarily a scientific document. But you see a lot of those art of war type documents that kind of dominate in our Western military doctrine. A lot of idealism, not much actual critical methods and scientific method going in there. More, it's just a lot of assumptions going in there. And that goes into bias, which is another of the big problems, where people come in with preconceived notions about the others, and that forms a lot of mistakes along the way. Where if we had taken the time to understand the groups, the why that those groups are doing what they're doing, maybe some of those biases could be removed. And it's not so that we can agree with them or get along with them. It's so that we can understand how to solve this problem in the least violent means possible with the least amount of resources and so on.
Now, how have regular forces been able to conduct themselves in irregular war against irregular forces? And we do have a few examples, and we have mentioned them. First, there was the British in colonial wars, particularly like in Malaysia, but then there was also against the Mau Mau in what is now Kenya. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, the British offer a lot of examples, and I in my book I like to contrast the British and the French approaches because they are very different, but they both have influenced American military doctrine, which is interesting, and so has the German. And the British approach, it's very much a indirect approach that focuses on unconventional warfare, which means basically empowering a non-state force to go against a state force. The French, on the other hand, do the opposite, where they crush the non-state force to prop up the state force. And you can contrast those examples. For example, the British in Malaysia, they were fighting against a group that was actually Chinese ethnicity in Malaysia during the Malaya emergency. And they were able to understand how the other people, the Malay people, felt about these Chinese folks and use that to their advantage to overcome the Malay cause. Whereas the French in Indochina, not far away, were basically using all these tactics. They actually have a bunch of names for them, like quadrillage, tache d'oil, which is the oil spot strategy, and quartering people and removing them and building walls and all this stuff, a lot of engineering. Because the French approach to war in general is very engineering focused. They want to produce and build, whereas the British were looking more about direct action raids and getting the people to fight on their own, to build up an indigenous force to be able to fight on their own. Then you have the French in Algeria, which is where Roger Trinquier, you know, he actually was in Vietnam and he witnessed the defeat at Dien Bien Phu. So he watched his tactics completely defeated in Vietnam, took those defeated tactics to Algeria, and then tried to use them on another order of magnitude, which is kind of incomprehensible that you just witnessed all this not work, and yet you're going to try to use it again somewhere else. And they did it there in Algeria. They built walls, they built concentration camps, they tortured people, all kinds of things, basically a coercive campaign, which is different than the British campaign, which focused more on the people. How do we get the people to do what we want? Instead, the French were just trying to force the people to do what they want. Then you have the Germans, who a couple of different interesting examples, but one is the commando order that Hitler put out during World War II, which basically said that if a British or Russian partisan was captured without a uniform, they were to be executed on the spot. And that just illustrates how scared the Germans were of these apparently non-state forces, how dangerous they were against the German cause. But Germany also had this other thing that they used to, they called it combating bands or Bandenbekämpfung, which is basically these hunting parties that, well, they started out as like stag hunting parties, but they were now given the mission of hunting down people, like partisans especially. And that's where the Jaeger Commando came from, the Hunter Commandos, and a couple of these other concepts that we especially saw in U.S. counterinsurgency theory in Afghanistan, which, again, did not work when they were first developed, and yet we adopted them despite them not being effective. So then we have, you know, the U.S. in Vietnam and Afghanistan, Iraq, basically mixing, you know, a medley of these tactics together, without really using a social science approach. We did have some human terrain teams that were designed to kind of analyze people and things like that, but that was a back burner, you know, second or third priority kind of thing to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were defunded, so they don't exist anymore. It just shows you how important they were, because wherever the money goes, I think that shows some importance. And unfortunately, we continue to take that highly technological, highly mechanical, maneuver warfare centric approach that the French especially used, the British a little bit, which is a problem because those things did not work in many of the previous cases they were used, whereas some of the British methods did have some positive effects.
And one other legacy of the French example in Algeria was that one famous film, The Battle of Algiers, where it's, I've heard that it's even used even to this day as like a training manual, of sorts, like an example of like how do you fight like an insurgency or irregular war.
Yeah, actually, when I was going through the my entrance into Marine Special Operations Command, that movie was played in one of our classes, and we did a, you know, a case study analysis afterward, because the movie was actually made by the lead guy, the actual insurgent himself, after the war, and they defeated the French, and he made a movie about it. I think it was 2 years after the war ended, so it's very interesting.
Yeah. So what are some, let's get back to like the social issues. What are the common social conditions that irregular wars tend to arise? We kind of got to the fact that there's like a dysfunction of the state, or the state's just not meeting the expectations. Is there anything more to this dynamic that you want to talk about?
Yeah, social orders, again, go back to the expectation issue. So you might have, let's say you live in a very religious community. The social order you expect might point toward that religious community leadership to provide something to you, like a service, for example. When that service is not provided in a very deep way, there's going to become some agitation there, not from everybody, but from some people. And that's going to be a beginning, possibly, of a direction to go into for those who are agitating. Now, if the sovereign is smart enough or willing to recognize that, hey, this is happening, they could intervene. And that's the same in the other cases too. They could do something that would fix the gap between what the people expect and what they're getting out of that social order. If that gap is fixed, it's possible that that irregular war condition might go away. And I use a lot of these careful terms like it's possible and it might, because there's so many different factors at play here. You know, just like Clausewitz talks about, like uncertainty and friction and all this stuff. This applies everywhere, including irregular war. So the social order really depends on that expectation.
So what are some of the implications of irregular war in our understanding of the state and state sovereignty in the 21st century? I know it's common now to talk about a post-Westphalian order. For those who don't know, we're referring to the Treaty of Westphalia, which kind of establishes our modern conceptions of state and state sovereignty. So that's where they're saying it, where somehow the state is not the only player in the political world, so to speak.
Yeah, I strongly disagree with those who think we're in some kind of post-Westphalian world. I think that's an idealistic or a dream-related statement. Like, I wish it was this way, but it's not that way, because we have the United Nations, we have the Vienna Convention of 1961 that lets diplomats act the way they do. There are so many things, like the Geneva Conventions, the treatment of prisoners of war. All of these are pieces of evidence that point to the fact that the Westphalian system is very much alive. And look at how we try to defend Ukraine. I would argue that philosophically, the reason we most likely want to defend Ukraine is because it is a sovereign state inside of the Westphalian system. The world does not take kindly to states altering their geography, altering their territory and their borders. And that also, it serves as a rallying point that some countries that might not typically get along will agree on that point. So I think the implications are there, that we will have many more irregular wars, you know, and they'll take many different forms. We have, like we mentioned, Gaza going on right now, which will be a great case study in the future, you know, years from now, to look back at all the different factors at play in that conflict. And the implications are very important, because the most recent new state that we got was South Sudan and Kosovo, 2008, 2011 timeframe. Very unusual to get new states. And before that, the new states we got were after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that Westphalian system is absolutely the dominant state system. And I think that because, and you remember in the very beginning, I said that the state is a necessary ingredient for a regular war. And that state is the Westphalian state. So as long as that Westphalian state system exists, irregular war exists.
So what are some of the implications of the study of irregular wars in our understanding of social order and social solidarity in the 21st century? We have touched on this and how in some ways the irregular forces fill in some of the vacuums or areas where the state is more dysfunctional, but what are some of the wider implications?
Well, I think if we fail to understand why these problems exist in the social order, we'll basically be using a basket of tactics that are completely irrelevant to the conflict and expending lots of blood and treasure. And Afghanistan's a great example. If you do the math on 2001 to 2021, the US alone, not the whole NATO group, but just the US, $300 million a day, every single day for 20 years straight. That is a massive expenditure of treasure not to mention that is the major implication there, that we fail to understand what was going on socially that allowed our failure to occur. And if we had thought about that in an honest way very early on, maybe we would have taken a different approach. Maybe we would have used something else. Maybe we would have tried to solve the social issue first before trying to solve a military or use a military instrument to solve a social problem, which doesn't generally work out in anyone's favor.
This has been a very fascinating discussion. Do you have any final thoughts or maybe touch on anything in the book that we didn't get to?
My final thoughts really just suggestions for future research. So if anyone listening is interested in this stuff, I would definitely recommend, as I said, looking at Gaza and how social order, territory, and institutions are playing into the conflict, and then look at, could this be solved militarily or not? Because I think that's a very big question right now to research, especially after it ends, however it ends. It will be important to understand that. And then I would look at another great thing to look at would be the FARC in Colombia. We talked about Colombia a little bit with the drugs and things like that. But the FARC, you know, they were an enemy of Colombia for a very long time. Until recently, they decided to put their arms down and basically join that sovereign that they initially fought against, which is a very interesting outcome. It's an unusual outcome. And I think it's one that should be studied a little bit more to understand, well, what allowed that to happen? What motivated those people intrinsically to choose to put their weapons down and to basically join the forces that used to be their adversary?
Well, we always like to end our interviews by asking our guests, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually working on another book that's going through peer review, and that is a very deep analysis of one case. And in the book we're talking about, Theory of Irregular War, I talk about third-party intervention and about how some states intervene in irregular wars. Well, I wanted to pick one case and write a whole book about that. And so this case is about Iran, and it's about how Iran uses unconventional warfare, intelligence operations, and covert action as a foreign policy tool. And I was able to get a bunch of intelligence reports declassified from the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, and others. And I also used like 12 different languages of source material. It's basically something that has never appeared in print anywhere. And it's a very deep analysis of the last 40 years, how Iran uses military advisors all over the world, not just the usual places you might expect, how they use covert action and intelligence operations in ways you definitely would not expect, all based on primary sources and intelligence reporting and all kinds of things like that. And I'm very excited to see it hit the shelves.
Well, maybe when you finish with that, we could have you back on the podcast.
I would love to.
Jonathan Hackett, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.